All right, so the motivation. Why do we want to try to do inflation with our fundamental skills? Let me tell you the main reason. I'm spending my year at Princeton, and a lot of my colleagues out there are doing data analysis, and they have tons of scalar field models already available. And it becomes very hard to discern these scalar field models with current data. And part of the whole non-Gaussianity game is to, for example, further discern fundamental scalar fields. From a theoretical point of view, we know that certain fields are real in nature. Light vector fields, fermionic fields. So the question is, can we try to do inflation, go back to maybe Occam's razor and try to do inflation? Can we learn something in trying to build a model of inflation or other forms of cosmology, since I am agnostic about, I did work on VSL back in the days with Chuao, and I still think about it, but I'm talking about inflation today. So can we try to learn something about the earlier universe in attempting to build models like inflation from known fields, like vector fields and from fermionic fields? And in doing so, for example, might we get a surprise in new observational signatures that are unique to models of this sort, as opposed to scalar fields? So that's sort of, those are the three motivations. But there's a historical motivation, which is going back to your roots, as we say back home. Going back to your roots. So the roots of inflation, Guth and even Englert and Braut back in the days in the late 70s, was very much motivated by condensed matter physics, the notion of spontaneous symmetry breaking, and the application of spontaneous symmetry breaking to trying to rid yourself of magnetic monopoles. This was what Alan Guth worked on when he was at SLAC. We had the same office at SLAC, actually, but I wasn't as lucky as he was. In trying to sweep away these monopoles that formed by Higgs-like mechanism in SU5, got down to the standard model, Alan realized that the vacuum energy in this Higgs potential could drive what we now know as all inflation. And of course, that was a nice idea, but it didn't work too well. As you know, the tunneling processes to get you out of inflation created too much anisotropy. You ended up with what you started with. So there are new models of inflation, again, all of these were based on fundamental scalar fields. So let me just, because I'm going to come back to this, and we want to always contrast the new way of thinking about inflation, which I will present to you pretty soon, with the old way. So I want to be able to contrast these two different ways of thinking about, so you can be the judge as to what's a better way of thinking about inflation. My hockey stick. This is a true tradition at the Perimeter Institute, because at the old pub 10 years ago, 11 years ago, is it the same hockey stick? It looks battered. Did people hit other people with this? So these characters in the play here, well, not characters here, all nice people, friends of mine. But the simplest way to think about most models of inflation nowadays are based on the notion of slow roll inflation. And the basic idea is, take any complicated, well-behaved potential, zoom in, and you excite your scalar field at the initial time and some initial hypersurface. You tune this thing to be nearly flat, so this scalar field splits up into a classical, time-dependent field with no spatial inhomogeneities, and a tiny bit of perturbations, which will come back to do good things for you. But the important thing is that there is a phi naught, okay? There is a non-vanishing amplitude of this field at some initial time. The field equation for this scalar field, in this case, it's a massive scalar field, but you can have other interesting types of potential. It's all the same thing at the end of the day. You want to make sure that the field equations ensure that this kinetic term is subdominant to the potential term, unless we're talking about kinetic-dominated inflationary models. I'm talking about slow-roll inflation. And if that is the case, then you could ignore this term. Of course, it has to be self-consistent with the field equations. I'm not showing you that. You can obviously rephrase all this in terms of these slow-roll parameters and such. And what you find is that you can integrate this Friedmann equation. If this is nearly constant, the potential term, you will get an exponential phase of expansion in your scale factor. So that is the basic idea of how slow roll inflation works, and many models of inflation, including the D-brain models of inflation, were just simply applications of this old idea to other fields in nature. So the important thing here is that, of course, what's nice about these models of inflation is that as you get to the bottom of your potential, there's rapid oscillations, and thermal production of particles, if your inflation field is coupled to the other matter fields of the standard model, for example. We call this preheating. And so this is all very nice, but there is a caveat. There's something, an elephant in the room, or an elephant on the potential. As this, you assume that the scalar field was nearly homogeneous with tiny quantum fluctuations. The tiny quantum fluctuations that you now use to generate structure. So in other words, there's a quantum field theoretic calculation that goes into evaluating this power spectrum that Joao spoke about. And I thank Joao for covering that, so it makes my life easier now. Also corrects the inflaton potential. So there's a quantum correction to the potential of the inflaton, which involves the same calculation as doing the quantum perturbations for the power spectrum. And generically, that spoils the flatness of the potential. Okay, this is a generic thing in inflation. This is what we call the fine-tuning problem. It's not only a fine-tuning in the amplitude of the power spectrum, but there's a fine-tuning in the flatness of the potential that's necessary to sustain slow roll. Now, there are concoctions, there are models of inflation where you can have shift symmetries, for example, to protect you against these perturbations. But generically, I would say that this problem will come up to haunt you. And a lot of this boils down to a question of initial conditions, which is you have to really fine-tune your initial conditions on your initial hypersurface so that the universe, against quantum fluctuations, remain homogeneous, the background geometry. So one of the ideas that we will be playing with is to generically not start with that initial state. We're going to start with generically anisotropic energy momentum tensors, for example. So some open questions for inflation based on my past motivation, which was, what is the true identity of the inflaton field? You know, this whole idea, by the way, is dedicated to Robert Brout. Because when I, 6 years ago, Lee introduced me to Robert, and Robert really got me thinking about the real identity of an inflaton field, and maybe it might be something vector-like. So this is really where this is all coming from. And he wrote a paper called Who is the Inflaton? I strongly suggest everyone read that paper, because a lot of the ideas in this paper emerges from that essay he wrote. It's quite deep stuff. Can we find new connections between inflation and the standard model? So what I mean by new connections is that we have open-ended questions in the standard model that hopefully, if we built the correct model of inflation, would be connected to that problem in the standard model. And we will speak about one of those. The model that we're cooking up here is deliberately constructed to address one of those problems. So can inflation return to its roots and connect to the standard model of particle physics? So what I'm gonna now talk about is vector inflation. I know that Slava Mukhanov was here some time ago and he spoke about his version of vector inflation, but ours is dramatically different. Okay, and if there's time, I can get into that. But I know I'm not mad or as mad because Slava worked on it too, unless Slava is mad. this was nothing new. In 1989, Larry Ford proposed a vector field model of inflation. This was not a gauge theory, okay? This was literally, he had vector fields with no gauge symmetries. And, right, you can see what the problem is. Vector fields they have a direction, and inflation is designed to make the universe homogeneous and isotropic. So you have a problem immediately. the slow roll conditions were difficult to realize naturally. Larry had to put in some crazy type of potential for this vector theory, and these things were not slow rolled. In other words, we're going to realize that you cannot think about slow roll inflation when you introduce vector rolls. So slow roll goes out the window. And so what? This goes back. Why build another model of inflation? Why waste your time? I know John is looking at me. Now you're finally shaking your head. You're smiling now. You're not shaking your head. So why do this if it buys you nothing new? So again, we're going to revisit Larry's problems. And so I actually drove up to Tufts one day out of desperation, and I knocked on Larry's door. And the dean was having wine and cheese, so Larry, I went and I got some wine, and I had a nice discussion with Larry. And he then told me what the problems were, and that was very helpful. Oh, by the way, I totally forgot. I want to really thank and acknowledge my collaborators, Dave Spergel and my great postdoc, who really toiled and worked really hard on this project. Antonino Marciano, who's in the Marciano, who is in the back of the room there. So before I present the equations, what I'm going to do is tell you what the basic physics is, what the idea is. So when I showed you slow roll inflation, I want to be clear about what the assumptions that went into are. So green represents the initial hypersurface at the beginning of inflation. And this represents the particular things that are necessary so that you have a consistent initial condition for inflation. So the first thing is that you do have to specify or normalize your geometry at that initial time. The second thing one has to do is, again, specify the value of the amplitude of this condensate, or your scalar field, at its height from its potential, and also the initial value of the potential at that time. And also, you need to specify your vacuum state for these quantum perturbations. So again, there are certain assumptions that are made about these types of vacuum states. The ones that I will use are the ones that minimize the energy at that initial time. These are called the adiabatic or the Bunch-Davies state. Okay? There are other choices to be made so that I can compare what we're doing here to inflation. Let's make an assumption about this state. In our model, we're not doing anything dramatically that different. Instead of having a scalar field, what we're going to start off with is the initial density of a vector field and a fermionic field. No scalar field. But we will be required to have a very interesting state that people have studied in oblivion, okay? But it's going to turn out to be very interesting. So I will not tell you what the state is yet. We will derive this state if there's time. It will demand itself on us.
Can I guess from the initials?
Yes. It's slightly related to that, but so this is our theory. I'm deliberately I'm leaving out other parts. It's simply, this is all in curve background, so we have to have the inverse metric here. We have a Chern-Simons term, okay, and we have the plasma term that comes from gauge invariance, A mu, J mu. Now, the important thing I want to point out here is we need this term. You will not get inflation in this model without this term. That's the first thing. I'll get back to that in a second. Because we have fermions, we have to self-consistently make sure that everything we're doing with the fermionic equations are self-consistent with the geometry and the gauge field. Otherwise, you're not really doing anything correct here. We will ignore this four fermion term. It comes from torsion, but it's Planck suppressed. Okay, and any questions so far?
Is J5 the current that comes?
Yeah, this is the chiral current. It could also be the vector current. It wouldn't matter, but thanks for pointing that out. So J5 is psi gamma mu gamma phi.
So the last terms of both lines are the same term?
Which one?
Yes.
This is, yeah.
That's the same as
yeah.
That.
I just, for clarity, just wanted to isolate this term here.
What is the gauge rule?
Thank you. Very important. It's U1 to the N. It's many copies of U1. And that will become clear why we need that. So I just wrote down, so this trace is over those gauge indices. Okay. So there's a paradox here. That theory has no masses in it. So it's completely, this is the connection to this conference. The theory is conformally invariant. Any Yang-Mills theory that's massless is conformally invariant. And we can see that immediately by just looking at the trace of the energy momentum tensor. If I put these gauge fields in perfect fluid form, the statement that the theory is conformally invariant is that the trace of the energy momentum tensor is zero. And if I look at this, this corresponds to pressure that's one-third rho. So that's a statement that I have radiation. So the gauge fields coexist as a radiative state. And that's why this theory is conformally invariant. However, if I was really trying to do inflation, I claim that I'm gonna give you inflation with this theory, okay? There's a problem here, there's a paradox, which is that to get something like inflation, quasi the Sitter space, I need this, which means that the theory is no longer conformally invariant. But this goes back to the statement about my state. The way we're gonna resolve this paradox is that at that initial hypersurface, I'm explicitly, and I will spontaneously break that vacuum state, okay? And hence, the conformal symmetry. So let's see how this works. If I go back to my energy momentum tensor, the claim here is that I'm gonna get inflation by demanding or showing that this term remains nearly constant during the phase of inflation. And you want to think that this thing is sort of like the vacuum energy that's dominating inflation. So I can see some heads already looking doubtful that because of your intuition with how fermionic fields and gauge fields traditionally behave in expanding backgrounds. But there's another worry before we even get to that. The worry has to do with if I claim that this is a term that is in my energy momentum tensor is vacuum dominated, then notice the magnitude of this. If it was large, there'll be an anisotropic piece, an off-diagonal piece in the energy momentum tensor that would also dominate as much. So you somehow have to manage to keep this term large and suppress this, but at first glance seems very hard to do for U1 theory. We don't worry about these terms because these terms go as 1 over a to the fourth. So how do we get around that? Well, we get around that by starting off now, going back to my initial condition, and saying that I have many copies of the gauge theory. So think of a magnet. If the net magnetization is zero, it means that all the little magnetic domains add up because they have random orientations. So if I start with a white noise spectrum at the initial hypersurface of many gauge fields, what happens is that, and I average, so I sum over all the different flavors or colors, depending on how you, the scheme of your gauge theory. I prefer colors, U1 to the N gauge symmetry. Then what happens is that you get a lead and order term that is isotropic for the A dot J, and a term that, then the off diagonal term, there should have been two indices here, that goes to the square root of N, so that the ratio of the isotropic part to the anisotropic part scales as 1 over the square root of N. So in the limit that N is large, or if, even if it's n is 10, I get that this term is perturbative. So that's how I kill the anisotropic part and keep the isotropic part. So the idea is to populate my theory, not my initial, but my theory naturally has many gauge fields, and if my initial surface is random, then they will just average out, and I would get anisotropies, but they will be suppressed by 1 over the square root of n. So that's the first, so what I'm now gonna look at now, since I've dealt with the issue of anisotropy, we will look at the Friedmann equation and see how that shows up again. We need to show the following thing. Let me just get to this since I am running out of time. So we're working in conformal coordinates. And this is what my Friedmann equation looks like. So notice that my electric and magnetic field will redshift as 1 over a to the fourth. But my a dot j term, oh, by the way, plus and minus correspond, we are working on a chiral basis. It's important that we work in a chiral basis because the thing I'm going to connect this to is baryogenesis, and we will need chirality to talk about this. So notice that if this term remains constant and dominates over these two terms, okay, I can have the hopes of igniting inflation. How would this happen? This would happen if the following thing occurs. If the fermionic current goes as some constant, which is my initial fermionic field, 1 over A, and my gauge field gets amplified and grows with the scale factor, then their product at later times will remain nearly constant. The question is that realized by the field equations? And the answer is yes, if J goes as 1 over A. So that's the key thing. That's the thing that I want you to take away with you. Well, let's look at this equation. This is my field equation for the gauge field, sourced by this fermionic current. If the fermionic current goes as 1 over A, this is in a chiral basis, okay? This goes as A cubed. Let's ignore this term for now. And what you find is that, indeed, in conformal coordinates, A double dot is proportional to A cubed. The solution is that A will be proportional, the gauge field will be proportional to the scale factor. That is if J goes as 1 over A, of course. So it's a plasma, it's what we call the plasma frequency. Okay, this is how you shine light through, this is how materials become transparent. Yes?
Just a comment, in isotropic and homogeneous, F alpha W, F alpha beta 0. Because the spatial component of the vector field is 0, so you take the curl.
I don't think his vector field is not, that has a special component.
Yeah, it has a special component.
There are lots of them, so it makes it.
Yeah. I'm not looking at a time like a purely time dependent vector field. It has spatial dependence. But as I pointed out before, they average out.
If it's a spatial, it's a time directional dependence.
That's right. That's right. So this is the field equation in a Fourier basis, by the way. So, after a lot of hard work, Antonino went and he found exact solutions of the gauge field. This is what it is. We have the homogeneous solution. This is for the left-handed helical component. There's another solution for the right-handed. And this is the peculiar solution, which are these integral sine functions. But there's and you can show that even in the presence of this Chern-Simons term, that you would also get that A grows as a scale factor. Okay. So, but all this boils down to, does J really go as 1 over A? And the answer is, of course, so if you buy all this stuff, then you end up with a consistency condition in the Friedmann equations that tells you on the left-hand side, Hubble square is proportional to the initial value of the fermionic current divided by Hubble square, and that immediately leads to that you will get inflation if A plus and A minus are equal, almost equal in amplitude, the initial gauge field. It's 10 to the minus 5 M Planck. You can't mess with this number. So it tells you that inflation must happen around with densities at the level of gut scale. And there's no free parameter here. Okay? This is the consistency condition that you're led to. And also similarly, your fermionic current is roughly 10 to the minus 30 M Planck cubed. So why do this model of inflation? But anyway, I'll get back to the interesting thing about what goes on with the fermions. But I'll just say something very quickly. You have a question?
Yeah, what is the function of the topological term, Chern-Simons term?
What is
the function?
You will see it. It's in this slide here. Yeah. But we don't need it, but we wanted to connect this thing to baryogenesis. So this is based on some old work with an old dear friend, Shaheen Sheikh Jabari and Mike Peskin, and then David Leith followed up, tried to prove us wrong, but then he realized he made a sign error. But he thought we made a sign error. And of course, I believed it because I make sign errors all the time. But
So, but did he believe that he made a sign?
No. But then Shaheen, you know, what Shaheen dealt with it. So how does baryogenesis work? So we know we need these three conditions to hold. And it turns out inflation, according to this paper we wrote a long time ago, 2005, is really one condition. Because what happens is that inflation, if inflation is being sourced by a CP-violating event, well, in this case, it's the fact that you have A left and A right that are slightly different from each other. Okay? That's because that was our initial state. Then, if inflation is sourced by that, inflation is naturally a state that is out of equilibrium. So any particle physics process that's happening during inflation is much slower and always going to be slower than inflation itself. So what inflation does, it provides a natural ground for the three Sakharov conditions because it's so rapidly inflating. So inflation in our case is already CP violating because the left-handed and the right-handed initial gauge field, are different. This is going back to your question about the Chern-Simons, because what happens is the solution of these, the A plus and A minus, the amplitudes are different, but the phases are the same. So when I perform a parity transformation, the amplitudes don't change. So A left is not equal to A right under parity. So if you buy this, I hope you do. You got CP violation out of equilibrium because inflation puts you out of equilibrium from the same thing. But then something really cool happens, and this is what I want to talk about, which is there is that J5. And so that tree diagram from textbook physics, because I have these extra U1s, are anomalous. And so I will naturally generate these triangle anomalies, and hence this equation. This equation is for the global fermionic current, such that if this term is not zero, and it usually is zero, if this is not zero, then I will generate a net lepton number. So what we do is we plug in the value of the gauge field. It has to be time dependent. If it's not time dependent, this will vanish. And if A left and A right are not different, okay, I'm just plugging this number, I'm integrating during the time of inflation, and I'll get a number out of this. If you look at our paper, we plugged in the values of the gauge field necessary to get inflation with the assumption that it decays via this diagram, and we get 10 to the minus 10. The numbers just worked out, okay? You can look at the paper and look at the calculation, it worked out. We did have to fine tune something though.
How many gauge fields do you use in this case?
That dropped out of the integral. Yeah.
But in the previous part, how many gauge fields did you need? I guess to make universe homogeneous or isotropic, you needed.
Well, that delta A has to be 10 to the minus 5, right? Compared to the other one.
So how many gauge fields do you
need? Square root of n, if square root of n is. Yeah. Not gauge field, no, but it's a color symmetry, right? So.
But I'm just saying, where are these fields now? Because these would be all massless particles.
They're dark. They're dark. They're Z prime bosons. I'll get to that at the end of the talk. But it's something we haven't resolved yet. To be honest, we haven't resolved that issue. How much time do I have, Tom?
20 minutes.
Oh, I'm fine.
People are getting. That
the 15 minutes that we started today. Okay. So, and plus people probably want it. Okay. So the point is that this mechanism provides a natural framework to also talk about baryogenesis, where the baryogenesis mechanism is connected to the dynamics of the inflationary theory itself. So that's kind of interesting. The numbers seem to work out. There are some caveats about how you make your assignments to the hypercharge. But that's the basic thing. How does inflation end? This is open-ended, okay? In this case, we need to, the best we can do right now is to reintroduce a scale of field. But the scale of field is not, okay? The scale of field is not needed to sustain or initiate inflation. So again, the problems with the scale of field for using the scale field for inflation doesn't come up here. But I do believe, and I'll end with a better idea of how to end inflation, but this one, at least you can solve equations and see. The basic thing is that this topological Chern-Simons term, if you promote this theta angle to an axion field, okay, then what happens is that this field is also slowly going down its potential. It's a very shallow potential. And by the time it gets to the bottom of its potential, it starts to oscillate asymptotically. And the gauge field now obeys a Mathieu equation. So what happens is that this gauge field basically becomes radiative. It's no longer flux, and it decays, and inflation ends. It no longer sustains this growth like this A, this dependence on the scale factor. It actually starts decaying like ordinary radiation. Yes?
Sorry, once you have axion, you can inflate with the axion.
I wanted to stay away. I'm very familiar with natural inflation. And all the problems, most of the problems that natural inflation has, okay, that scale field models of inflation has, the natural inflation has. So there's a reason why I didn't want the potential of the axion to dominate inflation. So that's what I wanted to keep away from. But at the same time, this is a very model-dependent statement I'm making here. There are other ways we can think of event of inflation.
So what problems axion inflation has that you overcome with this model?
Well, in this model, I don't have a coupling constant in this model. I just had the initial value of the gauge field. I had a consistency condition that tells you what the initial value of the gauge field and the fermion current is. Okay, so there's no fine-tuning. Obviously, we're going to have to go and do a calculation of the density perturbation, and that means our amplitudes better not be fine-tuned as well, right? So, and also, it was an exercise to learn something, new. And this is something that you're going to learn new, because even Professor Witten didn't know this. We spoke about this, and it took a month to come back with an answer that satisfied him. So this is something new here. The fermions, you can just, if you densitize these fermions, you quarter densitize them, and you want to do that. So for all the loop quantum gravity aficionados, we learned in this treatment that it's good to quarter densitize fermions because the quantum mechanics comes out correctly. So if you quarter densitize this and you can solve this Dirac equation. The fact that A is real just shifts the phases here. And what you find is, of course, as you should expect, classically the current just goes as 1 of A to the fourth because the field goes as 1 of A squared. So what we're doing is just, I'm explicitly doing a mode expansion because we're going to come and use that later on, okay, for the fermions. But this is not what we need to do. We're doing inflation. We have a state. We have a vacuum state. And all the quantum fields are excited out of that state during inflation. This is going back to what Leonard Parker taught us back in the 60s. Okay, if you want to do quantum fields in curved space, you have to pay attention to the background geometry that the fields are evolving in and the states that you are assuming. If we assume a Bunch-Davis state, which is very similar to the asymptotic Minkowski state, we have to quantize our theory in that. And the best method to do that is not by using perturbative methods. The best method is what Bharat Ratra and Michael Peskin, when he worked with Michael, did was to solve the functional Schrodinger equation. To my knowledge, the best papers I found is by Roman Jakief and Klaus Kiefer. And it was applied to inflation by Bharat Ratra. And the basic idea is that you solve this functional Schrodinger equation and you solve for the state, okay? And you see this becomes non-trivial because the Hamiltonian of the fermions knows about the scale factor since you've densitized it, okay? So we want to find what the state is. Well, after some guessing around, okay, and beers and things like that, we found that, well, after talking to Leonard Parker, that we should try an excited Bunch-Davis vacuum. What I mean by that, it's a coherent state with phases, okay, that acts on, so you have these phases over many modes, over this excited Bunch-Davis vacuum state. So what you have is an exponentiation of the creation and annihilation operators, All right, so it's a state that is already excited. That's why we have J naught. That's why you have all these fermions at the very beginning, because these are quanta that's already been excited at the initial state. How it got there, that's a different story. But what we're going to find is that these phases are now time dependent. Because notice that I'm taking a time derivative of this state on the right-hand side, and it better agree with a cube at the left-hand side. Okay? In fact, this Lee was aware that when you visited last year at Haverford, this was kind of where this whole story started. But the point is, if you now go and solve for this function of Schrodinger equation, demand that the left-hand side is equal to the right-hand side after some algebra, you find that the phases have to pick up a dependence on the scale factor with some, that depends on one over the Hubble parameter. And so what happens at the end of the day is that your coherent state, the phases now, the wave function itself, okay, knows about the geometry. The probability distribution also grows. And therefore, the expectation value of the number operator of the fermions also grow. You create fermions as you inflate. But this is nothing more than Leonard Parker's result, just a different way of thinking about it. So we basically reproduce Parker's result using this other method. So if you do this, and now you go and you calculate the expectation value of the fermionic current, it goes as 1 over A. So that's basically at the end of the story. Going back to, there are particular models called leptophilic dark matter models, which says that if you have couplings to the standard model that are leptophilic, in other words, they don't like to couple to the Z boson, then there's something called a Z prime boson. So a good candidate for the other copies of the U1 fields are these Z prime bosons. The thing that's interesting is that the rate that you're producing lepton asymmetry will be also the same rate that you're producing these dark particles. And we know that at last scattering, there are four factors larger than each other, right? They're around the same value. So this model has a little promise of telling you that the baryogenesis mechanism might be very similar to the dark genesis mechanism, but that's something to be pursued. There are issues about these G1s and these Gs, how you couple, what assignments you make. There's a lot of particle physics to understand here that is beyond me at the moment. Where did these U1s come from? Well, you know, there's a story I like to make my string theory friends happy with, which is that, the whole point of this model is to try to do inflation without needing this, but one way to worm out of this is to say that you can have many D-brains overlapping and you can have U1 factors.
Okay. I was asking, where did they go?
Oh, where did it go? I don't know where it goes.
Why don't we see all these particles, U1 particles, like contributing to expansion?
Well, at the end of inflation, they should just decay away as radiation.
Yeah. But these are massless particles.
These are massless particles.
Have a good decay.
Just like ordinary gauge fields decay, massless gauge field. It goes as radiation.
They have no phase space.
Well,
I think you could assume that they are massive, but with masses way less than the Planck or the Brendon high scale, so that they have to decay before the Big Bang decrogenesis. So
that's the breakfast U-band symmetry, right? So you said it's because if they have U-band symmetry, then they should be massive. I guess that's fine.
Yeah.
Those are like axioms.
And one interesting thing is that because inflation is being sourced by such terms, and as I said, So inflation, of course, at leading order is sourced by terms that look like this. But these perturbations source anisotropic stress. And the usual assumption in inflationary models, at least driven by scalar field, assume that these anisotropic stress vanish. In other words, there's no vorticity. But because inflation is actually being sourced by these terms, it could be that these models may distinguish themselves by producing large-scale vorticity in the CMB. And that is one thing that we are now looking at. You see, it must be true if that went off. That's too much of a coincidence. So we're now in the middle of dealing with these nasty calculations to see if whether or not what type of vorticity we get, meaning at what scales do they take place, and whether or not they're at scales that are going to be observable in the future polarization experiments. And then, of course, this is going to be the thing that might kill the model at the end of the day. We are currently working with João and Antonino and Johannes, how do you pronounce it?
Johannes.
Noller, to basically calculate the contribution to the curvature perturbation and whether or not we get the correct amplitude and also the correct spectrum. Let me close by saying that I very much look at this model as an idea that can be applied to other cosmological scenarios, okay? Not just inflation, but because, as I said, there's this issue of the initial condition that I've yet to address. I think that's pretty much it. Yes, John.
Just a quick comment. The first paper I published on biometric gravity used a vector. So it's B times E mu A mu. It gives similar results to what Charles was showing us. So I used what you would say is a physical vector, not the E mu part.
So you use literally a vector field itself. Yes.
So did you also consider the fluctuations of the A field?
Yes.
So I found also the 10 to minus 9 for the perturbations.
In the simplest scenario, we have done that calculation and we found that it's completely, you know, it's much less than 10 to minus 9. So we don't get the correct amplitude.
Oh, I see.
But we have a non-Abelian version of what we're doing now. That seems to be a little bit more promising, but time will tell.
How can you prevent the kind of spontaneous magnetization of Grumman walls? In principle, they can occur.
That's true. I mean, it's a question of whether or not these are stable. These are gauge defects, so usually gauge defects are not stable. Right, unless there's some kind of topology.
We can check.
Yeah, we can check. It's a good question.
And another question, maybe. It's pretty fair that you can write down the supersymmetric action. So you kind of assume that the algebraicing will happen before inflation, but it can change the picture.
Well, I mean, the one thing I do know about supersymmetry is that the minute you introduce anything that looks like a cosmological constant, supersymmetry is just explicitly broken. So supersymmetry does not, inflation does not like supersymmetry, as far as I'm concerned.
There are no more questions.